Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with biological anthropologist Richard Wrangham about the provocative ideas in his latest book, The Goodness Paradox. Let me set you up first of all. After a three-year hiatus since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book, No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book, Strangers in Their Own Land and the Stories That Divide Us, Robert Wright on why he's a Buddhist. The show airs his specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, which is also iTunes, Podomatic.com, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net. That's TerrenceMcNally.net. Now, a quick plug for participation. Ever since I started re-recording, I've been putting these websites out each show. And there are ways to either resist what's happening in the Trump administration or work towards what we need as a healthy and just society. The most prominent organization is Indivisible.us. Indivisible.us. They've got about 5,000-6,000 local chapters, and they'll tell you every week sort of things that you might plug into. MoveOn.org, which for has been around since 92, I think, or no, about that time. It's been primarily a digital activation website, but since Trump's election, it's gotten much more involved in coordinating with the grassroots. MoveOn, one word, .org. And California has a similar thing, California-oriented, called the Courage Campaign, couragecampaign1word.org. And then a couple that are very specific are 5Calls. That's the number 5 and the word calls, 5Calls.org, which tells you timely and relevant calls you can make to your representatives. And townhallproject.com, which tells you when your representatives are going to be meeting with constituents nearby, and you can go and see them in person. Now to today's guest. How is it that humans can be both the nicest and the nastiest of species? Biological anthropologist Richard Wrangham wrestles with that question in his latest book, The Goodness Paradox, The Strange Relationship Between Virtue and Violence in Human Evolution. While our capacity for coolly planned and devastating violence remains unrivaled, he offers a strikingly original theory of how, over the last 250 million years, humankind has become an increasingly peaceful species in our daily interactions. According to Wrangham, the acquisition of language and the practice of capital punishment have been determining factors in the rise of culture and civilization. My question at the end of all this, besides how did he figure it out, what does it mean, and so on, is can this understanding help us to accelerate or sustain our social evolution so that we're better able to deal with our darker impulses in a world that may well grow more hostile due to population growth, climate change, those sorts of things? Richard Wrangham is Ruth B. Moore Professor of Biological Anthropology at Harvard and founder of the Kabali Chimpanzee Project in Uganda. He's the recipient of a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship and a fellow of both the American and British Academies of Arts and Sciences. He studied wild chimpanzees since, well, his own center, I think, began in 1987, but he'd been doing it before that. His books include Demonic Males, Apes and the Origins of Human Violence, Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human, and his latest, The Goodness Paradox. Welcome, Richard Wrangham, to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work.
Thank you. Absolutely lovely to be here.
Okay, and let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Sunday, April 21st. So, Richard, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about, and we've got an hour. So can you tell us briefly about your path to the work that you do today? You know, feel free to go way back, some childhood inspiration, mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sorts of thing.
My goodness. Well, you know, I've always been delighted by natural history. So if I go back to deep origins, I was a bird watcher. I loved being in nature. And as I got older, I was introduced to evolutionary theory. I think it was 1960. So that was the 100th anniversary of the publication of The Origin of Species, literally 1959. And a series of books came out then, and I was 11, 12 or something, and started to get entranced by evolutionary theory and grew up being fascinated by how we can think about humans in relationship to the rest of the natural world. And that was the time, by the way, in the 1960s, that you got books that really tried to make a big impact in that way, like Desmond Morris's The Naked Ape and Robert Ardrey, The Territorial Imperative and African Genesis. So there was a kind of swirl of excitement developing about the notion that after the Darwinian Revolution had established itself as a system that was legitimate biologically, then the question was, how could you apply it to understand humans? And that was the sort of orienting set of stimuli that I found when I went to undergraduate at Oxford University and read zoology. So I did my concentration in zoology. And after that, I wanted to study an animal that might help us understand the principles that could have guided us towards human evolution. And you might imagine that that was going to be chimpanzees, but actually it wasn't. It was going to be a little mongoose, the banded mongoose. But it turns out that I was unable to do that study, and I ended up, by chance really, just through personal connections of my tutor at Oxford, asking Jane Goodall if I could be a research assistant with her. So she at that time had done 10 years of work on chimpanzees and was beginning to get famous. And I was very lucky. I went there at a time when she really wanted some help with research assistants because she was doing less time herself in the field. And after about an hour of arriving at the field station, you know, I realized that I was dealing with a quite different kind of species. And so I've had, you know, 50 years or something of the privilege of working with this extraordinary species, which is, you know, sort of not exactly half animal, half human, but it feels in that kind of liminal state. It feels though it's got something fascinating to teach us.
Okay. And what role did Jane Goodall play in, you know, your early stages, the development of your research or your career?
She was the director of the field station in Gombe National Park in Tanzania, where I did my work. I spent 1 year as her research assistant. She came to the field maybe two or three times for a few days during that time. We all, of course, the eight, something like that, students who were there, thought the world of her. And I think the big lesson that I would have probably taken away from her is of sort of fidelity to the reality of what you see. You know, William Boyd wrote a book called Brazzaville Beach, in which he suggested that an observer of chimpanzees, seeing things like what Jane Goodall had seen about their violence, would try and hide it. And nothing like that could have been could have applied to Jane. You know, she was very, very clear about the importance of just being absolutely honest about what you see, regardless of what might be some slightly alarming implications. So I think that, you know, that more than anything was what I enjoyed about beautifully sort of simple and clear approach to being in nature.
Yeah, and as it turns out, since you end up studying, at least in this book and in Demonic Males, violence, it seems that advice is very, you know, on point.
Well, yes, and it was an incredibly exciting time because we were just really discovering, and even after 10 years, it had not been clear what the social organization of the chimpanzees was. And now, for the first time, a series of us were following chimpanzees wherever they went, rather than simply observing them in a relatively small part of their home range. And that took us to the boundaries of the ranges and showed us for the first time the extraordinary hostility that they showed to members of neighboring communities. So we were discovering this and trying to make sense of it. And, of course, you know, that's a really exciting opportunity.
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying, that since that violence is only displayed on the fringes where they're confronting another community, one could have an entirely different interpretation of their behavior if you never saw that.
Well, that's right. And skeptics about the work that emerged in the 1970s, which said, gosh, look, chimpanzees are capable of extraordinary violence. The skeptics said, well, wait a minute. Jane Goodall said that chimpanzees are extremely nice and affectionate and trusting and cooperative. So all of this stuff must be wrong. It must be the consequence of people interfering with them. So that was a hypothesis. Now, 20, 30, 40 years later, you know, we know that that skeptical hypothesis is wrong. And the basis on which we know it is that if you survey all of the different chimpanzee long-term sites, you can find that there is this astonishing consistency in the patterns of violence. And actually, if you try and correlate that pattern of violence with human interference, you find that there's no relationship at all. This is just something they do.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk just briefly about the findings in your book, Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human, just so people can, and we'll talk about demonic males, but I'm saving that one because it seems to me to be the foundation, if you will, or the starting point for the new book, The Goodness Paradox. But Catching Fire, what was the discovery or realization? How did you make it, and what does it mean?
When I was following chimpanzees, I would sometimes go without food all day, in terms of carrying it, because I was studying the feeding behavior of chimpanzees. I got to know all of the different species of plants and animals that they ate, and I said to myself, well, look, you know, they're our closest relative. Let me try eating what they eat. Let me try surviving on what they eat, now that I know exactly what it is. And I could get access to the food, and what I discovered was that I was just intensely hungry at the end of the day. It doesn't matter how much of their food I could get access to. And that was what set me off onto a voyage of discovery, which is very exciting, because what I realized is something that is in some ways blindingly obvious, which is that humans absolutely need to have access to cooked food to be able to survive in the wild. People who are committed to raw food diets in contemporary West, where they survive on agricultural foods produced by supermarkets from different places all over the year, still find it very difficult to get enough food to maintain their body weight. But in the wild, you just can't do it. And so the story of Catching Fire is the story that at some point, humans became biologically adapted to eating our food cooked, requiring it in the wild. And then the question is when. And the argument that I produce in the book, based on the biology that we can reconstruct in fossil species, is it must have happened 2 million years ago, about 2 million years ago, which is the appearance of the genus Homo, and particularly the species Homo erectus, which was the first one that really looked like us in terms of being fully erect, bipedal, about the same body size, with similar, relatively small intestine. And then that has huge effects. You know, once you control fire, then you've really left the ordinary state of nature that every other animal is in.
And one thing you said is we evolved so that it was required.
Yes.
That, do you mean it was required by nutritionally that we now had adapted a system that needed that much energy from its food?
Yes. I mean, so what happened is that during evolution, I think around this time, about 2 million years ago, our guts became markedly smaller, about two-thirds of the size that our ancestors' guts had been. And that happened because our ancestors started eating their food cooked and therefore didn't need to have the fermentation chambers and the big capacity to take in lots of raw food that is relatively poorly digested. And so once they'd taken advantage of the fact they were eating cooked food, they discovered, as it were, that they could not go back to eating or relying on raw food. So it's required for humans based on nutritional grounds.
Wow.
We absolutely need to eat our food pre-digested, as it were.
Yes.
Having it cooked.
Right, that the process of cooking it echoes in some ways the process of digesting it.
Yeah, and so once the food is cooked, then we are pre-adapted, just like every other animal is, mm-hmm. to enjoy it. So if you offer cooked food to an ape that has never experienced cooked food, they will eat it up. They will prefer it to raw food because it has the qualities of food that they can understand are good for you nutritionally, namely that some of the molecules that are relatively difficult to digest raw are now easier to digest.
It seems to me that the effects we're talking about take time.
Right.
So an individual, the fire has been discovered, meat goes in the fire, he eats the meat. He has no idea about what we're talking about, these sort of, you know, energy.
Yeah.
But he just finds it. I mean, you get where I'm going. Of course, that becomes speculation. Other things you can do, but that's total speculation. What do you think? I mean, why does that one and the one next to him and the other five around the fire decide, yeah, let's go with this?
Well, of course, you say him, and of course, you know, really we should be thinking particularly about her, probably.
Right.
And that is because a major constraint on evolutionary success is access to energy, access to calories. And what cooking does is to increase the availability of calories enormously. It increases it partly because it increases the digestibility of the food, that is, the proportion of the food nutrients that actually get digested. And it also increases it by sparing you the energetic work of digesting the food.
Sure.
One way or another, probably you get something. We still don't know exactly, and obviously it depends on the food, but I like to think of it as 30%, 40%, 50%, even maybe more increase in the calories that you get out of your food. Well, this is huge. You know, a farmer nowadays who increases their milk production by 5% is a millionaire. It's the same with animals in the wild. If they can get that much more energy, then they are a millionaire. They are the ones whose babies are born more frequently, who survive better in the face of diseases that require immunological defenses, and live longer. So suddenly, those individuals who happened to be able to eat cooked food because they had discovered fire were the ones whose evolutionary success was outpacing everybody else. And now there would be selection in favor of those who got the advantages all the more. The ones who got the advantages all the more would be the ones who happened, you know, as a result of genetic changes, not to have those big stomachs and the big teeth of the past, because it becomes more efficient.
Very, very good. Okay. I mean, that is all so fascinating. And you know one thing, Richard, that I love about it is that the study grew out of your own personal experience.
Yes, and you know, I've always been fascinated by the fact that nobody had drawn attention to this before. And it seems so obvious in some ways. I mean, you know, everyone's fascinated by diet, particularly if you're an evolutionary biologist, because everyone knows that diet's fantastically important in giving you energy. And cooking is obviously a signature feature of the human diet. And it seems to me so amazing that people haven't focused on this. And it took actual experience
That's
of
right.
trying to eat raw food
yeah.
in the wild to, you know, for the penny to drop pretty
yeah.
slowly.
No, I love that. They left dropped. It. They left it for you.
Well, yes, of course, you know, lovely for me. But there's, you know, Claude Lévi-Strauss, the great French structural anthropologist, in the 1960s, writes a book called The Raw and the Cooked. And you know what he says? He says that it's incredibly important that humans eat their food cooked, but it's all for psychological reasons.
Oh, my.
He said that we need to find a way to distinguish ourselves from the animals.
Oh, no.
Because of, you know, it satisfies our need to identify ourselves.
We're the ones who eat cooked food.
Yes, that's right. And he said, we can eat our food raw if we want to, and nobody corrected him.
That's what I was going to say. So that stood for X number of years as a worthy theory.
Indeed.
Wow. I really appreciate that, Richard. Okay, let's move to demonic males, apes and the origins of human violence. That one I know was written in the wake of two big discoveries, and it has to do with the realization, which I've learned through preparing for this and reading your work and so on, that bonobos were actually discovered quite recently.
Yes, so the two closest relatives to humans are equally closely related to us, and they are chimpanzees and bonobos. And they live on either side of the Congo River, which winds across the equator in Africa. They never meet in the wild because they're separated by this big river. They look so similar to each other that if most people would see these individuals, they wouldn't know there was a difference between them. You have to sort of learn to recognize the difference, as is shown by the fact that they were in the hands, literally, of Western scientists for a decade or two before people realized there were two species. And then eventually what was discovered was that even though they look incredibly similar and the degree of difference in size between the males and the females is the same and their body weights are the same, nevertheless, their behavior is extraordinarily different. And the difference is that chimpanzees are far more aggressive in every way you can think of, whereas the bonobos have a great suppression of aggression in relationship to chimpanzees. And incidentally, and a lot of people have made a lot of this, are much more sexual. They have a much greater diversity of sexual behavior among all different age sex classes. So an extraordinary psychological difference between the two species that are most closely related to us.
And so as you say, as we point out, the discovery is made. And then once we have these two species with such different behavior, then that led to the examination that led to your book, Demonic Males. What is the finding there? How did you make it? And what does it mean?
So the big finding, this was, I read it in the early 90s with Dale Peterson, and the review at that point was sufficient to be able to say that there were these huge differences in aggressiveness at two levels. One is within the groups, and the other is between the groups. So bonobos and chimpanzees have similar social organization in the sense that they form communities that occupy a particular area of land and defend it against neighboring communities. But within the community, males and females go in somewhat protean subgroups. So the average might be somewhere between 5 and 10 number of individuals in a subgroup. And this is constantly changing. It might change hour to hour. It might change day to day. Who is traveling with who? That said, there's a big difference. And within the groups, within these communities, one big difference is this, that even though the sex ratios are pretty similar, in the chimpanzee subgroups, males tend to outnumber females, which means that females are often on their own. And in the bonobo subgroups, females tend to outnumber the males. And this sets off a series of differences that ultimately mean that the chimps are more patriarchal and the bonobos are more matriarchal. Male power rules in chimps, female power rules in bonobos. So that's one huge difference. Then the other difference is what happens when members of neighboring communities meet.
Mm-hmm.
And the chimps are completely hostile. They never have a friendly relationship with any member of a neighboring group. If they meet a lone mother of the neighbors, then even if she's in sexual condition, they might attack her. If she's got a baby, then they are likely to try and kill it. They will be quite mean to a mother in the sense of grabbing her and pulling her down slope and kicking her and so on. Only rarely has such a female been killed. But if they meet males, then they will try and kill them. Now, when I say try, they're very judicious about the circumstances. If there are several males that they meet from the neighboring community, then they shout at them, maybe charge a little at them, but don't engage physically. But if they found one, and there are quite a number of them on their own party, at least five, and on average eight when this happens, then they'll attack that one and will kill that individual. Contrast that to bonobos. When they meet with members of neighboring groups, we didn't know much about this in 1996, but we do know much more now. It's incredibly reduced in terms of hostility. They can occasionally have little sort of little spats, but they can groom with the members of neighboring groups, just relaxedly going through each other's hair. They can have sex with members of the neighboring group. They can play with the juveniles of the neighboring group. They can go and meet individuals that were once a member of their own group. So it's an astonishingly relaxed tenor. Very, very different from the hostility of the chimpanzees.
This is 96. You come up with this. You write this up and so on. But for you, it presents a question that has persisted with you through the new book, The Goodness Paradox. And I'm sure this is all a work in progress in any case, and will continue on. But yes. Talk about that, if you will.
Well, the big comparison that I made in Demonic Males, Dale Peterson and I wrote, was between the aggressiveness between groups of chimpanzees and humans. And the point there was that chimpanzees are a very rare example of an animal that makes deliberate efforts to kill members of neighboring groups. And they do it pretty regularly, and it involves males from one community going out and looking for opportunities to attack and kill males of neighboring communities. Obviously, that sounds quite like war, and it sounds particularly like the sort of small-scale war that is practiced by mobile hunter-gatherers and people living in small horticultural settings in forests around the tropics, where there's no tribal chief, there's no state organization, there's just small anarchic groups of people who are trying to survive, and they end up being at war with sometimes their neighbors. And that war consists of raiding attacks, much like what you see in chimpanzees. So in Demonic Males, I drew attention to that. Now, in The Goodness Paradox, the problem that I reverted to that had not been really addressed was, okay, chimps and humans show similar patterns of intergroup aggression, but the patterns of within-group aggression are very, very different between the two species because, cutting to the chase, the frequency with which chimpanzees attack each other physically, chasing or pounding or kicking or whatever it is something like, I would estimate, 500 to 1,000 times as frequent as it is in humans. So in humans, it's relatively rare and rather disturbing if we ever see two people literally having a physical fight. Other than, you know, when it's boxing and it's organized.
Right. I heard an interview where someone said, but wait a minute, you know, it's clear we're becoming more rowdy, there's more bullying, all these sorts of things. But you say, no, in the macro, when you look at it, especially compare us to a chimpanzee.
Well, entirely in comparison with chimps, that's right. Because, you know, it may be that there's an increase. Actually, I don't think it's true. But,
right.
But even if one has the perception that there's
yes.
an increase in the frequency of this physical violence in, say, the United States, it's nothing like what you see in the chimps, because in chimps, on a typical day, you will see this kind of physical violence.
Okay.
And so we know, we've totted up the numbers, and it's two or three orders of magnitude greater in chimps than it is in humans. So that's the fascinating puzzle. How is it that we are similar to chimps in one way, namely the pattern and even frequency of death from war. And on the other hand, we have this huge difference because within communities, we are so relatively unaggressive.
And one of the things you point out is that this is really hard to figure out if you think that aggression is aggression, like a rose is a rose.
Yes, you know, for, what is it? I mean, it depends on which discipline you're in, but for several decades, going back as many as something like eight decades, if you're in biology, people have realized that aggression takes two very different forms. One is the aggression that in some ways seems more familiar, which is the losing your temper when somebody insults you or takes something away from you or you find somebody in bed with your wife. You just react. It's all thoroughly emotional, and you kind of lash out. This is the kind of aggression that is promoted by alcohol, is promoted by testosterone, by fatigue. So this is reactive aggression. And then the other type is proactive aggression, which is the calm, premeditated type that is not necessarily associated with any kind of emotional arousal, but serves the individual's interests in, as they perceive it. So the individual is sitting there planning, how can I take money from that person, kill that person because of what they did. This is aggression that is it's calm and planned, and animals do it too. And what has been appreciated over the last few years is that the two kinds of aggression are organized in the brain in slightly different ways. And what that means is that over evolutionary time, they don't have to be necessarily associated. Some animals can have a very low version of reactive aggression and a high version of proactive aggression, and vice versa.
Yeah, no, I think one thing I found fascinating was that, we study, we see behavior, we define things, but the fact that the brain actually processes these two kinds of aggression differently, that takes it to another level. That's just not some theory that's going to change in 20 years when we feel differently.
Yes, exactly. Right. And we can see it in domesticated animals where you can actually see the evolutionary change happening in the two kinds of aggression independently.
Okay, so now we know there's the two different kinds of aggression. The question, and you say it exists in other animals, but I think what draws you, I'm assuming what draws you to explore it in humans is that we're sort of on the end of both continuum.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, what's so striking about us is that we're so extreme. We're extreme in our use of proactive aggression in the sense that we kill an extraordinarily high proportion of members of our own species. And by the way, amazingly, that all the evidence is that we kill more members of our own species when we're living in small-scale societies than we're living in the highly militarized states of contemporary world. So, you know, the number of people that die from proactive violence is not quite as high as it is in wolves, but there are very few species in which it's greater than in humans. And then on the other hand, with our reactive aggression, just as we have this greatly diminished propensity for reactive aggression compared to chimpanzees, it's true compared to almost all animals. We are very, very downgraded for our tendency just to lose our temper in the face of frustrations with members of our own community. So we're extreme in both ways. We're extremely violent in relationship to proactive aggression. We're extremely non-violent in relationship to reactive aggression.
And that is the goodness paradox, correct?
It is, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so let me tell people, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with biological anthropologist Richard Wrangham about the provocative ideas, as you can tell, in his latest book, The Goodness Paradox. Richard, I would love to hear about your work process. And I'm going to quote actually a little bit from the New Yorker review of the book by George Shialaba, because I thought he put it so well. He said of your work in The Goodness Paradox, "The ideas are literally far-fetched. Relying on observations from Siberia, the South Pacific, the Amazon, Tierra del Fuego, and elsewhere, as well as on the work of archaeologists, paleontologists, psychologists, biochemists, neurophysiologists, and geneticists. When you're trying to answer a question or come up with an explanation, and in this case, a demonic male set it up for you, you've been kind of pursuing it for 20 years since, how do you go about it? What is the puzzle solving like for those of us, you know, outside the field?"
Well, I think that in my case, the problem came to me from the comparison of chimpanzees and bonobos,
mm-hmm.
because of the equation, as my student Brian Hare crisply said to me one day, that chimpanzees in relationship to bonobos is like a wolf in relationship to a dog. And the idea that bonobos are a sort of equivalent of a domesticated version of chimpanzees turns out to be fascinatingly true. So the kinds of biological differences that you find between bonobos and chimps are not only that bonobos are so much less aggressive than chimps, but a whole series of other features rather surprisingly associated with domestication. And so the first process that led me in the direction of understanding the human condition was to really take that hypothesis and run with it, to take the idea that bonobos are a self-domesticated version of bonobos. And it sounds weird. It takes a little bit of getting used to. And I constantly wanted to test and challenge that idea to see whether or not it was really going to be able to stand up to scrutiny. And so, you know, when you quote the fact that this book investigates lots of different angles, then that's because I want to make sure that the ideas can withstand scrutiny from all sorts of different perspectives. You know, this may sound rather sort of unscientific in the sense that there's a very strong lead hypothesis that I'm investigating, but my defense against criticism of that type would be that I'm perfectly prepared to reject the hypothesis, but I want to make sure that it's as strong as, or to see how strong it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so it turns out that that is a very extraordinarily convincing hypothesis. I mean, you know, the way I think about it is this, that domesticated animals tend to differ from wild animals in a series of characteristics that archaeologists and biologists have long listed, which include a shorter face, a lighter body, smaller teeth, reduced degree of differences between the sexes, and smaller brain. All of those things apply to bonobos compared to chimpanzees, as well as a difference that is common in a number of domesticated animals, which is that in the domesticated version, you see a retention of features that are expressed only in the juveniles in the ancestral wild species, but then those features end up being in the adult of the domesticated species. And that's true of bonobos, too. So having found all those things, then it was, well, even, of course, before having really established them as clearly as they are now, established now, I got fascinated by the idea that this could apply to humans.
Mm-hmm.
Because for a long time, people have thought that humans are similar to domesticated animals, in the sense of our reduced aggressiveness. And I wanted to explore the idea that we actually are domesticated animals. And so then the process rewinds in the same way as I did for bonobos and chimps. You want to see, you know, if you're going to put this idea out there, you better make sure that it is covered in all different perspectives. I mean, if it's true, if it's a realistic idea, it's going to be workable through whatever disciplinary area you look at it. So let's check and see if that premise applies.
What I'm gathering is that on the one hand, you've got this puzzle in front of you. How do these pieces, how does this evidence fit together? And on the one hand, you've come up with a hypothesis. And what was the hypothesis that you came up with originally related to humans self-domesticating themselves, or was it the more refined hypothesis regarding capital punishment?
No, the first hypothesis was that humans had self-domesticated themselves. Well, you know, I'm hesitating just when I said that, because maybe there are two strands of thought independently here. I think we have to bring in the name of Christopher Boehm, who is an anthropologist, who is one of the very few people, and I count myself among this very small group, of people who studied both chimpanzees and people. He was originally a social anthropologist, and then he spent some time in Gombe working with the chimpanzees in the 1980s and 90s, I guess it was. And he was fascinated with the differences in the male hierarchy of chimps and humans, because in humans, you have a relatively egalitarian hierarchy, whereas in chimpanzees, you have an alpha male who completely dominates and bullies all of the other males, as well as the females and juveniles. And he said, how is it that humans are able to escape this problem? And in a 1999 book, he said, it is quite clear what happens, which is that humans have got a way of dominating the potential alpha male by using cultural means, and the big cultural means in the end is execution. If the human who is being cajoled or ridiculed into not being a bully, if he refuses to obey those social enjoyments and continues being a bully, then eventually, in a world without prisons and any other kind of state authority, then they have to just get rid of him. Well, in that book, he did not say that there would be any genetic consequences of that.
Uh-huh.
And I read this at a time when I was thinking about the problem, and I said to myself, but wait a minute, if this goes on for many thousands of years, then there would be genetic consequences, because there would be erosion of the genes that underlie excessive bullying in males. And so, this is a long answer to your question.
No. One thing that I heard in the answer was you were pointing out that among the chimpanzees, that the alpha male bullies, abuses, and ends up having more of the children, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it really pays.
Yeah. So in that model, you are now selecting for alphaness and bullying, because right? Whereas
you sure are. That's a great point. Exactly. And that's what happens in all of the equivalent social primates, the baboons and the gorillas and the chimps and many others. The alpha male bullies his way to the top, and then it pays off in spades.
And four generations, exactly.
A disproportionate number of the offspring, and selection favors bullying.
Right. Yep. And what you're pointing out now is that once you have the culture that enables you to plan the group execution of the bully, of the alpha, now the children are going, you're going to have less children from those bullies, and you begin the genetic adaptation.
You begin the reversal, exactly, that's right. And instead of selection favoring the bullying, selection is going against the bullying and producing a nicer kind of human.
And of course, the wonderful sort of, I'm sure you even beamed when you kind of put this together, is that what you are saying is that proactive aggression ends up decreasing reactive aggression through this action of capital punishment.
Well, that's right, because until you recognize that you have this separation of aggression into two biologically distinct types, then it's a puzzle. Because until you recognize that, you've got the problem that aggression is reducing aggression. And it doesn't seem to make sense. And the net result would be a wash.
Right.
But once you, with proactive aggression of the form of capital punishment, reducing reactive aggression of the form of bullying, now it all makes sense.
Yeah, and thus, there at that pivot point, if you will, the trail begins toward humans becoming the extreme of both proactive and reactive.
Exactly, that's right. Yes, and so, you know, if you look at the record of the anatomy of our ancestors over the last 300,000 years, then it looks just like a record of an increasing division between those two types of aggression.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we see is an increasing and indeed accelerating form of anatomy that looks like a domesticated version of the wild ancestors over the last 300,000 years.
Okay, now this is something which to me was brand new, and my guess is to an awful lot of people was brand new, but goes back to Darwin. This realization, this discovery that a decrease in reactive aggression, which we can call domestication, actually has physiological anatomical changes that are consistent across, you say, even birds. Talk about that, because I'm sure listeners will have their minds a bit blown by this.
Well, it is rather astonishing. It's been a puzzle for people who've been specializing in domesticated animals for years, that they have a series of parallel consequences. And Darwin drew attention to this, in the 1860s.
Yeah.
He claimed that every species of domesticated mammal has some individuals, and often many, that have floppy ears, ears that just flop downwards. And he said, how extraordinary that in the wild, you can only find one kind of animal in which has floppy ears. And your listeners may know what that is, and namely, it's elephants.
Right.
So a remarkable difference. Well, this is iconic of a whole series of differences. One of the fascinating ones is brain size. So brains reduce in size in domesticated animals compared to wild animals, and here's where we can see it in birds. Turkeys, ducks, geese, they all have small brains in relationship to their wild ancestors. In the case of turkeys, I think it's 40% reduction. The typical reduction is more like 10 or 15% reduction. And why this happens is still a matter of all sorts of debate and discussion. The really exciting breakthrough in understanding the biology or the fact of the domestication characteristics being associated in this way came with experiments that started in the 1950s in Russia, in which initially foxes and then later rats and mink were deliberately selected purely on the basis of their emotional reactivity. And within a few generations, it turns out that they are changing in the direction of these typical kinds of characteristics found in domesticated animals. So you choose to breed foxes from the tamer ones, and guess what? Within 10 generations, you're going to get white spots on the forehead and white toes on the feet. There's this wonderful tie of biology between the reduced aggression and these various characteristics. And you can list maybe 15 or 20 characteristics of the domestication syndrome, as it's called.
Right. So I want to make 2 points about that. One is that you actually are, the field has actually pretty much discovered why this is, because it seems, you know, one of those astonishing correlations. And you say that it happens in fetal development.
Yes. This is still a theory that is looking very promising, that hasn't been well worked out, but I think all the betting is on the idea that there's a particular kind of cell type, the neural crest cell, which begins very, very early in development, in humans about 3 weeks after conception. And it spreads around it starts on a sort of stripe on the what you might call the back of the little blob of the embryo, and this cell type spreads around, and it is apparently very important in affecting fear and stress and aggression. For instance, the adrenal glands that produce the stress hormone cortisol are produced as a result of the neural crest cells settling into a particular body and producing the adrenal, turning into the adrenal. As people have looked in detail at the neural crest cells, it seems as though they can explain, the things happening to them can explain all of the features of the domestication syndrome. I mean, as one example, they produce the cartilage that goes inside the ear. And if they don't produce enough, then the ear becomes floppy. Yeah. And the basic idea is that the way in which you select for reduced aggressiveness is you select for reduced pattern of migration of the neural crest cells, and this leads to the changes that we see in the domestication syndrome.
Yeah. Now, one other thing I want to touch on about that is this decrease of brain size that up until, 300,000 years ago, the human brain was steadily increasing in size, and since then, it's been decreasing.
So 300,000 years ago is when we'd see the first glimmerings of our own species, Homo sapiens, in the sense that at that point, for the first time, we see our ancestors becoming a little bit less robust, the males becoming a little bit less male-like, reducing their width of their faces and the projection of their brow ridges and so on, teeth becoming smaller and the face becoming shorter. But it wasn't, the brain continued to increase in the case of humans for another 200 and something thousand years. And so it's only in the last 30,000 years that we are clearly seeing a decrease in the brain size of humans. But it is an astonishing thing that our brain size actually did decrease.
Yes. In other words, that runs against everything we've sort of been thinking or taught to think. But you point out that while the increase in size did seem to increase the power of the brain, this decrease in the last 30,000 years does not decrease the power of the brain.
Right. So if you compare domestic animals and wild animals under the best controlled conditions, it's not at all clear that domesticated animals are stupider than the wild animals, even though they've lost a significant chunk of brain size.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, in a similar way, I think this is going to sound provocative, but in a number of species, including humans, weight for weight, the males have got bigger brains than the females. But again, there's no evidence that there's any sort of really strong cognitive differences in problem-solving ability between the sexes. It looks as though a major chunk of the, or a major part of the reason for having a big brain is to do with aggression. So, in some animals, what you see is that males and females, they grow together in parallel as their juveniles. And as they get to adolescence and early adulthood, they have the same brain size, or early adolescence. But then the females stop, and then the males carry on and get bigger brains. It's as if what they're doing with the extra brain size is promoting something about an ability to conduct aggression.
What's happening in society today? Macro statistics show we're becoming less violent, yet the rise of authoritarian bullies here and abroad, the regularity of mass murder in America, the seem to be a growing lack of empathy online and so on. Now, that may be outside your purview, putting that on the table, are there lessons from what you've learned in demonic males and then carried through into the goodness paradox that can help us cope, as I said, in a world that may, with population growth and climate change, become more hostile? And I sort of say that the migrations that are taking place now, often because of climate change, seem to be sort of a vanguard of that and the reaction to it and so on. So are there lessons for us in what you've been thinking about and studying?
Well, I'm certainly very cautious in thinking about, you know, extensions of biological anthropology into political science, but I will offer a couple of things.
Okay.
So the first would be we should take our innate tendencies seriously. You know, there's a great wish to think that all of our propensities for aggression come from cultural acquisitions, you know, from the way we're brought up and militarized and so on. And that if only we could get away from that, then we would all be delightful and nice. And I think that's unrealistic. We fit into a pattern that we can broadly explain among our different relatives, where we stand out. And it doesn't mean that we, because we've had a long history, evolutionary history, of proactive aggression, it doesn't mean it has to continue necessarily, but it does mean that we have to take seriously the possibility that it might. And for that reason, we should be very cautious about removing or getting rid of the institutions that have been built up over the years to help maintain peace, recognize when genocides are coming and do something about it, and so on. In other words, you know, be cautious. And the second point I would make is that the kind of good aspect of proactive aggression is that in animals and in humans, the way it works in the brain is that animals and humans don't set out to commit proactive aggression if it's likely that they personally will get hurt. And that means that you can, in theory, set up systems of defense which greatly inhibit the likelihood of proactive aggression happening. So in chimpanzees, if you happen to have an area in which the chimps can always maintain relatively stable groups, then you're not going to be caught on your own and you won't get these vicious attacks that happen in areas where they're more often alone. And that's a very simple model for saying it's worth investing in thinking about appropriate kinds of preventive systems.
What you're saying is don't kid yourself, and that goes back to the Hobbes-Rousseau thing, right, about the, you know, are we inherently
don't
violent?
Don't become an overall Rousseauian.
Yeah, that don't think we're inherently good and muddied by culture. We are animals, and we have these tendencies. And then
exactly.
Your second one is knowing that, develop, strengthen, put faith in systems that will minimize the chances of this happening.
And, yeah, particularly the notion that that if aggressors are going to get hurt themselves, they won't be aggressive. And the sort of worrying thing about this aspect is what's happening with social media, where you can be anonymous and direct, you know, really unpleasant systems of aggression towards others, maybe bringing in coalitions and ultimately possibly having real-life effects. And if the people sending out these messages are never hurt themselves, then it's understandable from a biological perspective why they would do it.
Right. The other thing that seems troubling to me is that the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun would sort of say, oh, yeah, if they know that the teacher's armed, they're not going to do this. That would be a conclusion one could draw, and we could make a lot of arguments why that's not true.
I'm with you.
Yeah. But,
yeah, exactly. But yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, you've got to be careful.
So again, the latest book is The Goodness Paradox, The Strange Relationship Between Virtue and Violence in Human Evolution. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net. That's TerrenceMcNally.net. Or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website, and that's one word, a world that just might work. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of guests and issues, plus usually 8 or 10 articles of relevance that kind of flesh out the conversation, email me at temcnally@mac.com, or you can sign up at my site. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. You can find years of podcasts at my site. Listen anytime, anywhere. They include Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Richard Wrangham. Keep up the good work.
Thanks a lot, Terrence.